This is Audible.
Chavs, The Demonization of the Working Class, by Owen Jones, read by Leighton Pugh. Preface to the 2016 edition. Chavs, written more than 5 years ago, is a polemic about a society that was unnecessarily unjust, cruel, and divided. Since its original publication in 2011, Britain has only become more unjust, cruel, and divided. The book appeared in print less than 12 months after the Conservatives returned to Downing Street after 13 years in the political wilderness, and it had three central purposes. To refute the myth that Britain is a classless society, when in fact huge amounts of wealth and power are concentrated in very few hands. To tackle the poisonous mantra that social problems like poverty are actually individual failings. And to encourage the idea that social progress comes about by people with similar economic interests organizing together to change society. In the 1980s, when I was growing up, Thatcherism remodeled British society. Since 2010, despite Tory leader David Cameron's initial avowals of moderation, his government has busied itself with an ambitious project for rolling back the state in an effort to complete Thatcher's work. On one hand, for the sorts of people who tend to fund the Conservative Party, not least those in the financial sector that plunged Britain into an economic mire, the last few years have been a boom time. During one of the great economic traumas of modern British history, the fortunes of the wealthiest 1,000 Britons more than doubled. On the other, the plight of working people stands in stark contrast. Workers suffered the longest fall in pay packets since the 1870s, and then there was the hunger. Britain is one of the richest societies ever to exist, and yet hundreds of thousands of Britons depend on food banks for their meals. A central plank of the government's programme was to reduce the welfare state. In order to justify this, a campaign of myths, distortion and, yes, demonisation was employed. The nation's finances were out of control, said the government, blaming excessive labour spending on schools and hospitals during the 1990s. Britain's huge deficit, so the allegations went, arose from reckless Whitehall largesse, not the global financial meltdown. The welfare bill, standing at £251 billion, needed to be slashed. Here was a deliberately misleading conflation of spending in different branches of government to create one single image of desperation. In fact, most of the money within the welfare budget goes on pensioners who have paid in all their lives. And indeed, the government was quick to assure voters that their pensions and entitlements would be protected. In contrast, the amount spent on unemployed people, which is what the electorate was encouraged to understand by welfare, is only a relatively small fraction of Social Security spending. Yet this group took a disproportionate amount of the blame for the welfare crisis. Support for the government's efforts to cut back on spending depended on portraying the recipients of Social Security as work-shy, feckless freeloaders. It required the ruthless and unapologetic application of the politics of envy to hammer its point home. Low-paid workers faced having their in-work benefits slashed and were getting wages that could in no way sustain a comfortable existence. But when they should have directed their ire at the government or their employers, they were encouraged to resent the unemployed people supposedly living it up at their expense. Since the 2008 crisis, rather than helping the poor, Tory ministers have openly condemned them as skivers and shirkers to exploit divisions within the working class. In the House of Commons, David Cameron announced, "We back the workers, they back the shirkers." The Chancellor, George Osborne, asked, "Where is the fairness for the shift worker leaving home in the dark hours of the early morning, who looks up at the closed blinds of their next-door neighbour, sleeping off a life on benefits?" Demonisation has become an ever more powerful instrument of divide and rule. I began Chavs by detailing the story of Shannon Matthews, a young girl who was kidnapped by her own mother in a perverse attempt to extort money from the tabloid press. The media and politicians alike hijacked the case, hoping to persuade their audience that this wanton, aberrant act was emblematic of a broad swathe of society. the Chavs. The handling of this story foreshadowed an even more sinister manipulation of individual cruelty. At the beginning of April 2013, Derby resident Mick Philpott and his wife were sent to prison for life for the manslaughter of six of their children. It was a sickening crime. Philpott had set fire to the family home, hoping to blame his mistress, who had left the house she shared with him and his wife, taking several children with her. It was a story of habitual violence and misogyny. Philpott had tyrannized his wife and mistress, both of whom worked while he was unemployed. When he was a soldier in the late 1970s, he had shot his then-girlfriend with a crossbow, claiming her skirt was too short, before he eventually stabbed both her and her mother. But the Daily Mail knew an opportunity when it saw one. Just hours after Philpott was sentenced in court, the newspaper plastered, "Vile product of welfare UK," across its front page. Here, it stated, was a damning insight into a welfare state that subsidised shirkers. Even though much of the Philpott's income came from in-work benefits, this was, after all, a working household. This atrocity was thus twisted into an indictment of government assistance. It was the sort of faulty logic and willful use of omission that had been previously used to create an erroneous connection between mass-murdering GP Harold Shipman and ordinary doctors, or to obscure the unfairness of inheritance in reporting the case of 46-year-old fraudster Stephen Seddon, who murdered his parents in 2013 for their £230,000 estate. Philpott's large family was portrayed as somehow typical of benefit claimants, despite statistics showing that out of 1.35 million families claiming at least one out-of-work benefit, just 190 had 10 children or more. The Daily Mail served an important function here. The paper helps to fan anger and resentment toward benefit claimants with every issue. It creates a climate in which the political elite can join in too. Never willfully missing an opportunity for political gain, George Osborne waded into the debate stirred up by the Mail's coverage of the Philpotts, suggesting that it was right to ask questions as a government, a society, and as taxpayers, why we are subsidising lifestyles like these. The Mail's campaign as a whole was an instructive lesson, a reminder that even the killing of six little children could be transformed into political fodder, their names barely even mentioned as their suffering was manipulated as propaganda. The truth, however, is no less shocking. According to the government's own estimates, around 0.7% of Social Security spending is lost to benefit fraud. But the Conservatives have created a system that drips extreme examples of such wrongdoing to the media, fueling the myth that there exist huge numbers of dishonest benefit claimants. Examples gleefully fed to journalists include a claimant pretending that officials had got him mixed up with his evil twin brother, and another trying to pass off his wife as his sister. This is bad behaviour, to be sure, but actions typical of only a tiny minority. Examples of unemployed people desperate to work, sending countless CVs to employers without eliciting a response, don't make for good copy on this government's press releases. Government attempts to stir up resentment against benefit claimants targeted in particular those low-paid workers who were struggling in large part because of coalition policies. This was calculated to reinforce the myth that benefit claimants were often better off than those slogging their guts out at work. For example, an initial cap of £26,000 was imposed on the amount that could be claimed, in line with supposed average household income. This in itself was a myth, because the average working family with an income of £26,000 could themselves claim several thousand pounds worth of additional in-work benefits. After all, millions of employed people qualify for benefits. Only a tiny number of unemployed people actually received more than £26,000 in benefits, and they either had large families to look after or lived in properties where landlords charged extortionate rents. But again, this was not about creating an effective social security net for the most vulnerable, but a political ruse. It was an attempt to turn people against each other. This puts an end to the out-of-control claims that saw some households getting more in benefits than many hard-working tax-paying families could ever dream of earning, as Ian Duncan Smith, Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, put it, seeding indignation among the electorate. To drive this message home, at the beginning of 2013, the Coalition unveiled the Welfare Benefits Uprating Bill, a piece of legislation that imposed a real-terms cut in benefits. This was British politics at its most base and cynical. For the first time since 1931, a government was intentionally slashing the incomes of the poor. Charities projected that hundreds of thousands of children would be driven into poverty as a result. Throughout the parliamentary debate, Tory MPs, many of whom are millionaires, jeered and guffawed as they prepared to plunge people they would never meet below the poverty line. "Today, Labour are voting to increase benefits by more than workers' wages," claimed a Tory poster. But in actual fact, the majority of those affected were in working households. Low-paid workers faced a double whammy of real-terms pay cuts and reduced tax credits, thanks to the Tory government, too. Worker and unemployed person alike were being mugged. The so-called bedroom tax was another example. In this proposed legislation, social tenants deemed to have a spare bedroom would suffer a cut in their housing benefit, forcing them to pay more to stay in their own homes. These were disproportionately people living in poverty with little money to spare. It was estimated that 2/3 of households affected had disabled residents. So-called spare bedrooms were often rooms for carers or customized for disabilities. If bedroom tax victims wished to avoid losing money, they had to downsize properties. But with a national shortage of one-bedroom social houses, this was simply not a feasible proposition for most people. The argument behind the bedroom tax was that it would free up desperately needed space for others. In other words, those living in overcrowded homes or trapped on a 5-million-strong social housing waiting list were encouraged to resent disabled people with a little extra living space, rather than attack the government for failing to build enough houses. At the same time, work assessments of disabled people were drastically expanded under the Cameron government. This process of testing people to see if they are able to work was initially overseen by the French corporation Atos, and led to many sick and disabled people being deemed fit for work and having their benefits taken away. Journalists and politicians vilified these put-upon individuals, suggesting they were falsely claiming disability payments, and this had very real consequences. In the early years of the Cameron era, disability charities warned that media and political rhetoric had driven a disturbing jump in the abuse of disabled people. The mental health charity Scope, for example, found that 2/3 of disabled people reported abuse in September 2011, a jump from 41% just a few months before. It was not just politicians and newspapers either who began to attack the poor. In an atmosphere of near hysteria, TV producers wanted a piece of the action too. Channel 4 announced that they were to broadcast Skint, described as an observational documentary focusing on a community in Scunthorpe, hammered by deindustrialization. When the show materialized, however, it foregrounded chaotic lifestyles and larger-than-life caricatures for viewers' voyeuristic pleasure. In similar fashion, another Channel 4 program, Benefit Street, hunted down unsympathetic benefit claimants on a street in Birmingham. The audience's reaction triggered a wave of demands on social media for the participants to be hanged or gassed. These are programs that aim to turn the poor against the poor, commissioned and produced by the privileged. I was waiting at a bus stop and a Channel 4 commissioning editor stopped on the way to work in their company-owned car to drop their child off at their private school, says veteran journalist Christopher Hurd. It was a complete emblem to me of the problem that these are people who are so well paid that they do not experience public services. They have a private health scheme at Channel 4, they do not experience state education, they do not travel on public transport. They live in a cocoon completely on their own, and this separates them dramatically from the day-to-day experience of the whole of the rest of the population, and particularly those outside of London. Then there was BBC Three's People Like Us, a show revolving around an estate in Harperhay, Manchester, which had the same approach. Local residents staged a furious meeting attacking a biased and distorted view of the community, and a local council worker, Richard Searle, whose daughter appeared in the programme, argued that the BBC should not be propagating this harmful and misleading image of the working class. Channel 5 staged a three-part series focusing on criminal behaviour. Shoplifters and Proud, Pickpockets and Proud, and, finally, On Benefits and Proud. Again, the focus was on extreme examples of the socially excluded, particularly from unusually large families like Heather Frost's, a woman with 11 children who had already been widely featured in the mainstream media. Many of these programmes barely gestured toward objectivity or accuracy. Take The Future of the Welfare State, presented by veteran BBC interviewer John Humphreys, which claimed that Britain was living in an age of entitlement. The programme was later found by the BBC Trust to have violated impartiality and accuracy rules. This out-and-out propaganda relied on the usual box of tricks, unearthing extreme examples, relying on interviews from biased sources, and not backing up audacious claims with statistics or facts. The Trust ruled that the programme left viewers unable to reach an informed opinion. Another line of attack was to encourage private sector workers to turn on public sector workers. In this way, real terms government cuts to public sector pay were justified in the light of the cuts private sector workers had suffered. Attacks on public sector pensions were defended on the basis that private sector pensions had been ravaged. Indeed, private sector pensions had been decimated, but that was the fault of private sector bosses, not dinner ladies and bin collectors. Throughout the 1990s, for example, companies saved £18 billion in pension holidays, even as their workers continued to contribute. Rather than turn on the boss, the shelf stacker and call centre worker, encouraged by the government and media, turned instead on the nurse and the teacher whose pension was intact. "Trade unions say they will fight to oppose public sector pensions cuts," wrote The Telegraph's Ian Cowie. "But they had better beware they can expect little support from the public because most savers outside these schemes can only dream of having such problems." Even this piece pointed out that two-thirds of private sector bosses paid nothing into their workers' pension funds, and yet Cowie maintained the argument that public sector workers should bear the anger nonetheless. It was pensions apartheid, he offered as an absurdly inflammatory comparison. The irony, then, is that one of the staple arguments of the right against those wanting the richest to pay more tax is that they are guilty of the politics of envy. During the 2015 general election campaign, the Tories pledged to slash £12 billion from Social Security spending, but, when pressed, refused to say where the axe would fall. When asked on national television whether spending on tax credits, which supplement the incomes of working people, would be reduced, David Cameron firmly denied it, responding, "It's not going to fall." When the Conservatives won a surprise victory in 2015, Cameron's assertion turned out to be untrue. Cuts to tax credits would leave over 3 million working families poorer by an average of around £1,350 a year. Millions of other working families would lose out too. The government trumpeted a rise in the minimum wage to £9 an hour as a living wage. It was nothing of the sort, even ignoring the fact that the living wage is calculated partly on the basis of what tax credits people were eligible to receive. In any case, as the Institute for Fiscal Studies pointed out, the increased minimum wage would compensate for just 13% of the lost income. Tax credits would also be offered to support a maximum of 2 children, in effect telling the children of supermarket workers and cleaners that if they had 2 siblings rather than 1, they would not receive tax credit support. It is notable how these policies were defended. The idea that the poor are breeding too fast and being incentivized to do so is age-old. Britain's poor law, prior to 1834, was assailed by its critics on this basis too. And this was the rationale behind restricting tax credits to two children, to tap into the idea that low-paid workers were encouraged by the state to have larger families. Here was an outright attempt to demonise working benefit claimants in a way that was already too common for unemployed benefit claimants. Part of the rationale was that low-paid workers simply had to work harder. Tory Cabinet Minister Jeremy Hunt announced that cutting tax credits conveyed an important cultural signal about the importance of hard work, and would mean British workers would have to work as hard as their Chinese counterparts. This was continuing a Conservative theme. The Conservative Cabinet Minister Liz Truss, for example, was among five Tory MPs who contributed to a book condemning British workers as among the worst idlers in the world, suggesting that too many people in Britain prefer a lie-in to hard work. If the Conservatives wished to decrease spending on tax credits and other in-work benefits without reducing the incomes of working people, they simply needed to raise wages. But the expansion of low-paid work in Britain has driven a rise in social security spending. Indeed, tax credit expenditure rose during the first Conservative term beyond initial estimates because so many were forced to take up low-paid jobs. The Tory argument was that work was the route out of poverty, but with more than 5 million British workers paid less than a living wage, and with most people in poverty in work, this was nonsensical. The man in charge of driving through social security changes was Ian Duncan Smith, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. In his constituency, Chingford and Woodford, 48.3% of workers are paid less than a living wage, the fifth highest proportion of any constituency in Britain. It is true that there have been some changes since Chavs was first published. The book was born, in large part, from frustration with the claim, "We're all middle class now." But this is an assertion rarely made today, not even by those on the right, though I should say I'm not taking credit for that. Even Conservatives make pitches at working-class identity, with some prominent Tories attempting to construct blue-collar conservatism. But there is so much more about class to discuss. As the book points out, what could be described as the working class has never been homogeneous. It includes people for whom life is very difficult, who are struggling for a secure, let alone comfortable, existence. And it includes people for whom life is okay, but could be so much better, and who face rising insecurity and fears about the future of their children. For those of us who aspire to transform society, we must build a coalition including both groups. For both low-income and middle-income, for those languishing in poverty, and for those working in an office on £28,000 a year, for those who call themselves working class, and those who self-identify as middle class. That means examining how class is evolving. It is projected that there will soon be more self-employed people than public sector workers. Around 1 in 7 workers are now self-employed. Many of them value their independence, and who can blame them, particularly in a country where power is intensely concentrated in the hands of bosses rather than workers. But many resent the insecurity. They often lack paid sick leave and maternity leave. The tax credits many receive are being cut. They find getting loans from banks difficult. They are frequently turned down for mortgages. They spend too much time chasing invoices for work they have completed. They are punished by inadequate infrastructure, like Britain's poor Wi-Fi network, and so on. Here are issues that must surely be championed by those who wish to transform society. We must also have a clear vision of what society should look like. In much of the Cameron era, the posture of the left has been anti-austerity, that is, a defensive approach. Austerity is a term that means little to many people. A coherent industrial strategy to create thriving renewable energy and high-tech industries, creating skilled, secure jobs. Public investment banks to help rebalance the economy, democratizing the economy. A just tax system, making the case for trade unions in raising both wages and productivity. Here, surely, are the approaches that desperately need to be developed and translated into a language that most people can understand. Injustice often seems daunting and difficult to overcome, but history tells us that what seem like insurmountable odds can be overcome. It is profoundly irrational for so much wealth and power to be concentrated in so few hands. Such a divided society is the source of needless insecurity, hardship and stress, of dreams that are never realized, of futures that are vandalized. All this injustice can be overcome. But as injustice is a collective problem, it requires a collective solution. People must realize that although they may have their differences, the differences between them are far less significant than those that separate them from power, and that if they organize together, their collective power can transform society. It is easier to write about this than to achieve it. Nonetheless, it remains my sincere belief that as our ancestors overcame injustice, their traditions will be inherited, and a far more just Britain and world will be built, however difficult that may sometimes be to imagine. Preface to the 2012 edition. Nobody expected Chavs to attract half as much attention as it did, and if it had been released even 3 or 4 years ago, I doubt that it would have done so well. But the book's impact had less to do with the provocative title and everything to do with the fact that class is back with a vengeance. During the boom period, it was possible to at least pretend class was no more, that we're all middle class now, as politicians and media pundits put it. As Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown had pronounced the end of boom and bust, and it seemed as though a future of rising living standards beckoned for all. At a time of economic chaos, this period looks like a golden age, even if we now know our sense of prosperity was built on sand. Yes, it was true that real wages stagnated for the bottom half and declined for the bottom third from 2004 onwards, that is 4 years before the economic collapse began. But the availability of cheap credit helped paper over Britain's growing class divisions, which, despite the hubris of the political and media elite, were as entrenched as ever. Chavs was my contribution to ending the conspiracy of silence over class, but unexpectedly it pushed at an open door. Economic crisis helped to refocus attention on the unjust distribution of wealth and power in society. Throughout 2011, living standards for the average Briton were declining at the fastest rate since the 1920s. The Child Poverty Action Group warned that poor families faced a triple whammy of benefit, support and service cuts, stating that the coalition government's legacy threatens to be the worst poverty record of any government for a generation. But it remained boom time for the people at the top. In 2011, boardroom pay for Britain's top 100 companies soared by 49%. The previous year it had shot up by 55%. The wealth of the richest 1,000 Britons, meanwhile, increased by a fifth, after leaping by 30%, the biggest increase ever recorded, in 2010. Shortly after arriving in office, the Conservatives' austerity chancellor, George Osborne, had claimed, "We're all in this together." As the statement veered between ludicrous and offensive, few were now making the case that class division no longer mattered in Britain. Although I wanted to encourage a broad debate about class, the title I chose proved contentious. For some critics, the book failed to acknowledge that the object of demonization was an identifiable subgroup of undesirables, a workless, Burberry-wearing underclass, rather than the working class as a whole. Sometimes, said these critics, I got bogged down in discussing the origins and definition of the term chav. Given that I had plastered the word across the book's cover, it would have been brash to refuse to engage in such a debate. But the book wasn't simply about the word. It aimed to challenge the myth that we're all middle class now, that most of the old working class had been aspirational and joined Middle Britain, whatever that was, leaving behind a feckless, problematic rump. This was often racialized and described as the white working class. Chavs was the term encompassing a whole range of pejorative connotations that best summed up this caricature. Shortly after Chavs was published, a study by polling organization Britain Thinks revealed just how demonized working class identity had become. As Chavs pointed out, most polls have consistently shown between 50 and 55% stubbornly self-identifying as working class, despite the "we're all middle class" mantra being drummed into us. But Britain Thinks revealed that 71% self-identified as middle class, with just 24% opting for working class. Undoubtedly, the contrasting results had much to do with the fact that while only one working class category was offered, there were three middle-class options to choose from: lower, middle and upper. But there was a more profound and disturbing explanation. According to Britain Thinks's Deborah Mattinson, a former pollster for Gordon Brown, there was a strong feeling in the focus groups that the noble tradition of a respectable and diligent working class was over. For the first time I saw the working class tag used as a slur, equated with other class-based insults such as chav. I asked focus group members to make collages using newspaper and magazine clippings to show what the working class was. Many chose deeply unattractive images, flashy excess, cosmetic surgery gone wrong, tacky designer clothes, booze, drugs, and overeating. Members of one focus group self-identified as middle class, another opted for working class. Their backgrounds, jobs, and incomes were almost exactly the same. The difference was that the middle-class self-identifiers were trying to distance themselves from an unappealing identity in favor of one with a strikingly positive image. As Deborah Mattinson put it, "Being middle-class is about being, well, a bit classy." The working-class label was no longer something people felt that they could wear with pride. Far from it. It had effectively become synonymous with chav. The minority that did describe themselves as working class struggled to come up with positive contemporary images to express their own identity. Focus group participants suggested the 1960s as the heyday of working class Britain. When asked to define what it meant to be working class, a common theme was it tends to just mean being poor. The Britain Thinks studies identified some of the consequences of the social and political forces that chavs had tried to identify. First, the Thatcherite assault on many of the pillars of working-class Britain, from trade unions to traditional industries. Secondly, a political consensus established by Thatcherism that we should all aspire to be middle-class, and that being working-class was no longer something to be proud of. Thirdly, the almost complete absence of accurate representations of working-class people in the media, on TV, and in the political world, in favour of grotesque chav caricatures. The term chav is used by different groups of people throughout British society. Practically nobody, except in jest, self-identifies as a chav. The term is almost always an insult imposed on individuals against their consent, but its exact meaning changes depending on who is wielding it and the context in which it is used. That said, as I have shown in the book, the term is undeniably used in a classist fashion. Take Chav Towns, a pretty nauseating website which, I'm proud to say, has added my name to its roll call of villains. Chav Towns ridicules entire communities. As it happens, my own hometown of Stockport gets a bit of a battering at the hands of anonymous individuals, brimming with undiluted class hatred. To be fair, Stockport has some very wealthy areas. Unfortunately, it has more than its fair share of scummy ones, too, says one. Another moans that, "I have to admit I feel ashamed to have to write Stockport on my address, despite being from one of its much, much nicer suburbs. Yes, they do exist." Yet another post, written by someone describing themselves as living in the charming village of Cheadlehume, savages people living on Stockport's council estates. But that's not to say this demonization is straightforward. In her review of chavs, Lindsay Hanley, author of the brilliant Estates, An Intimate History, argued that class hatred wasn't simply a one-way street, but a collusive, often subtle process which demeans everyone. In fact, a great deal of chav-bashing goes on within working-class neighbourhoods, partly because of the age-old divide between those who aim for respectability and those who disdain it. Chav-bashing can often come from working-class people as an expression of frustration at antisocial elements within their own communities. Chavs attempted to put antisocial behaviour in a social and economic context. It was more likely to happen in communities with high levels of poverty and unemployment. But it's also true that the impact of antisocial behaviour and crime are class issues. Both are statistically more likely to affect working-class people than middle-class people. Those on the receiving end often, unsurprisingly, have little sympathy for the perpetrators, particularly if they share a similar set of difficult economic circumstances but do not themselves resort to antisocial behaviour. It's also not the case that hostility to supposed benefit cheats is the sole preserve of middle-class Daily Mail readers, the net curtain-twitching types who rant about gays and gypsies. If you are someone scraping by in a low-paid job, the feeling that there are people down the street living it up at your expense may well infuriate you more than anything else. It's an age-old example of the poor against the poor, and right-wing politicians and journalists exploit such sentiments ruthlessly. Extreme examples of benefit fraudsters are hunted down with relish by the tabloids and are passed off not as isolated examples, but as representative of an endemic and far bigger problem. The scrounger has become the public face of the unemployed in Britain. That's not to say there isn't a widespread understanding about the causes behind the increase in long-term unemployment. As one working-class self-identifier puts it in the Britain's Think study, "We've now got this benefit generation which started when Thatcher closed all of the industries." Chavs attempted to present a corrective to these exaggerated tales of benefit fraud. Such fraud, indeed, represents less than 1% of total welfare spending, and up to 60 times less than tax avoidance at the other end of the economic spectrum. Meanwhile, the idea that there are plenty of jobs if only people could be bothered to drag themselves down to the job centre is risible. All the evidence shows that most unemployed people desperately want work. They can't find any. At the end of 2011, the Daily Telegraph reported that there were 23 job seekers in the UK chasing every job vacancy. For every retail job, there were 42 applications. In customer services, it was 46. In some communities, the picture is even bleaker. In Hull, there are 18,795 job seekers chasing 318 jobs. There are simply not enough jobs to go round. But with this reality largely banished from our newspapers and TV screens, and with tax-avoiding business people a distant, abstract concept for most, it is a challenging case to make. The demonisation of working-class people also stems from insecurity or social distancing from those in superficially similar circumstances. Britain Thinks revealed that those belonging to groups most likely to be stigmatised as chavs can often be among the most vociferous in their chav-bashing. One long-term incapacity benefit claimant denounced chavs who were supposedly milking the system. So did two unemployed teenage mothers. This isn't classist contempt. It comes from a fear of being lumped in with a demonised grouping. Here is one ugly consequence of persistent attacks on the unemployed and teenage mothers. Prejudice can even be voiced by those who are themselves targeted. In large part, the demonisation of the working class is the legacy of a concerted effort to shift public attitudes, which began under Thatcher, continued with New Labour, and has gained further momentum under the Coalition. Poverty and unemployment were no longer to be seen as social problems, but more to do with individual moral failings. Anyone could make it if they tried hard enough, or so the myth went. If people were poor, it was because they were lazy, spendthrift, or lacked aspiration. The latest social attitude survey, published at the end of 2011, shows just how successful this project has been. Even as economic crisis swelled the ranks of the unemployed and poor, attitudes towards them hardened. With nearly 2.7 million people out of work, over half of those surveyed believed that unemployment benefits were too high and were deterring people from getting a job. Of course, few would have known from reading newspapers or watching TV that the job seeker's allowance was worth just £67.50, and even less for those under the age of 26. Another 63% believed that a factor driving child poverty was parents who don't want to work. Depressing stuff, but not surprising given the Thatcherite onslaught, New Labour's refusal to challenge conservative dogma on social problems, and the airbrushing in the media concealing the reality of poverty and unemployment. And, of course, such attitudes have political consequences. If you think poverty and unemployment are personal failings rather than social problems, then why have a welfare state at all? The Social Attitudes Survey revealed that support for the redistribution of wealth had fallen to just a third. Towards the end of Margaret Thatcher's reign in 1989, it was over half. Demonization serves a useful purpose in a divided society like our own, because it promotes the idea that inequality is rational. It is simply an expression of differing talent and ability. Those at the bottom are supposedly there because they are stupid, lazy, or otherwise morally questionable. Demonization is the ideological backbone of an unequal society. Another criticism facing Chavs was that it glorified a golden age that never existed, presenting a rose-tinted view of an industrial world that was finished off by the Thatcherite experiment. But I do not believe that this was the argument presented in the book. As Chavs emphasized, industrial work was often backbreaking and dirty. Women were often excluded from these jobs, and when they were not, they did not have the same status as men. There were countless other problems that a dewy-eyed portrait of the industrial past, written by an author in his mid-twenties, would fail to address. My point, however, was a different one, that the vacuum left by the massive disappearance of industrial work was often not filled properly, leaving entire communities bereft of secure, well-regarded work. Service sector jobs are, on the whole, cleaner, less physically arduous, and are better at including women, even if they are still disproportionately concentrated in the lowest paid and most insecure work. But such work is often less well paid, lacks the same prestige, and is more likely to be hire and fire. Call centres and supermarkets do not form the basis of communities in the same way that the mine, factory, or dock did. I was not, though, calling for young men to be sent down the pits again. Just because I was arguing that what replaced these industries was in some important ways worse, doesn't mean that I advocated a return to a vanished world. It was also suggested that I had a very one-dimensional view of the working class, that what I was actually talking about was a male, white working class. But in fact, many of the key examples of demonized figures portrayed as representative of larger groups of people were women. Karen Matthews, Jade Goody, and Vicky Pollard, for example. Indeed, class hatred and misogyny often overlap. I also wanted to emphasize the explosion of women in the workforce in the last few decades. Indeed, they now account for over half of all workers, though, of course, it must be pointed out that women have always worked, as well as doing much of the unpaid housework men traditionally refuse to do. A low-paid, part-time female shelf stacker was one of my suggestions for a symbol of the modern working class. We cannot understand class without gender. But that works the other way, too. Women's liberation must address class. But the retreat from class has often stripped it from the agenda, here as everywhere else. Chavs was sometimes referred to as a book solely about the white working class. One of the purposes of the book was to take on this narrow, exclusive image of the working class. Though Chavs are often regarded as white working class figures, it should be noted the book was intentionally titled The Demonization of the Working Class rather than The White Working Class. After long arguing we're all middle class, the media and politicians started talking about the working class again, but in a racialized form. The problems of the white working class were ascribed to their whiteness rather than their class. But Chavs argued against this false portrait. Indeed, working-class communities and workplaces are more likely to be ethnically diverse than their middle-class counterparts. Problems faced by working-class people who are white, like the housing crisis, the lack of good jobs, poor rights at work, declining living standards, safe communities, are to do with class, not race. These are problems shared by working-class people of all ethnic backgrounds. Where race does come into it is the fact that working-class people from ethnic minority backgrounds suffer from other forms of oppression and exploitation. The majority of British Bangladeshis and Pakistanis, for example, live in poverty, while black people are far more likely to be stopped by the police. Although it is important to address issues common to all working-class people, it would be wrong to ignore the extra oppression suffered by minority groups. One of the main reasons that politicians and media commentators started talking about the white working class was the emergence of far-right populism, as most prominently expressed by the British National Party. But Chavs argued that such movements were, above all, driven by social and economic insecurities. This, of course, does not mean outright racist bigotry isn't part of the story too. Despite the great strides made by the struggles against racism in post-war Britain, prejudice, bigotry, and discrimination remain massive problems at every level of society. Some felt that in exploring an interesting premise, I had got distracted by an outdated grudge against Thatcherism. As Philip Hensher put it in The Spectator, "The spread of contempt for the urban working classes is an important subject, but here it got lost under a welter of old-school moans about Mrs. Thatcher, as if anyone still cared." I would hardly wish to hide my deeply held antipathy towards Thatcherism, and Chavs can hardly be accused of doing so, but the book is, inescapably, about the legacy of the Thatcherite 1980s. I do not believe it is possible to divorce class contempt from broader social and political trends. One of the book's key arguments was that this new classism had everything to do with an offensive against working-class Britain, including unions, industries, housing, communities, and values. We still live in the Britain that Thatcherism built. A critique of it can hardly be dismissed as old-school moans. It was also suggested by some that the book suffered from a lack of theoretical explanation. I make no apologies for this. Although in recent years the idea of class has not been the subject of much discussion among academics and leftists, literature still exists on the subject. Unfortunately, it remains largely unread outside small circles of specialists. One of the purposes of Chavs is to present ideas about class to a wider audience. It also aims to promote left-wing ideas at a time when the left is very weak. That's why it was written in a way that was intended to be readable. I hope it succeeded in this. All these criticisms, indeed, were part of a wider debate. Getting people to talk about class, whether they disagreed with me or not, was exactly what I had intended. But the debate took an unexpected turn a couple of months after the book was published. For a few days in August 2011, it looked as though England was staring into an abyss of social chaos, and the demonization I had written about flourished like never before. August is normally the height of Britain's silly season. With Parliament in recess, news channels end up featuring extra helpings of fatuous celebrity gossip. When not speculating about one or other embattled party leader's future, or covering stories about talented animals. But 2011 was quite unlike normal years. In a year of upheaval, silly season was cancelled, and communities across England were overwhelmed with rioting, looting, and arson. The unrest began after the police shot dead 29-year-old Mark Duggan in the London borough of Tottenham on the 6th of August 2011. Duggan was black, and in Tottenham the relationship between the local black community and the police has a fraught history. In 1985, after Cynthia Jarrett, also black, died during a police raid of her house, Tottenham exploded in the riots that took their name from the estate on which they focused, Broadwater Farm. A policeman, PC Keith Blakelock, was killed during the unrest. It was the first death of a police officer during a riot for over 150 years. Though relations have improved since 1985, many in Tottenham, particularly young black men, harbour resentments against the police, who they feel harass them. Indeed, a black person is 30 times more likely than a white person to be stopped and searched under Section 60 by the police in England and Wales. The police kept Duggan's body from his family for 36 hours. Initial reports from the Independent Police Complaints Commission that he had fired on the police were widely disbelieved and later discredited. On the afternoon of Saturday, the 6th of August, hundreds gathered in a peaceful protest outside Tottenham Police Station. But within hours, the mood had turned ugly. People across the UK awoke the following morning to blanket media coverage of mayhem and smoking rubble on Tottenham High Street. What happened next was, for most, an entirely unexpected and terrifying disruption to normality. By Monday, the riots had spread to my own London borough, Hackney. It was my birthday, and with celebratory drinks cut short as nervous friends fled home, I cycled past boarded-up shops on Kingsland Road that were being defended by groups of Turkish men. From Barnet in the north to Croydon in the south, London's shops were looted and burned. Crowds of rioters rampaged through the streets. On Monday and Tuesday, unrest spread to other English cities, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Nottingham. There was a sense, even among more rational observers, that the country was descending into chaos. Not since the Blitz during World War II have so many fires raged in London so intensely at one time, claimed Time magazine. Amid the chaos, commentators looked at chavs in a new light. Partly, I suppose, because the word chav was being bandied around to describe the rioters, particularly on Twitter and Facebook. Fran Healy, lead singer of Scottish soft rock band Travis, described the unrest as the chav spring, in a tweet referencing the Arab Spring. Fitness chain Gymbox, which appeared in chavs as the promoter of a chav fighting class, announced that it would be shutting early due to the chav infestation. But above all, a link was made with chavs because the riots shone a light on Britain's fractured, divided society. I was one of the few commentators during that turbulent week asked to challenge the dominant narrative that this was mindless criminality, end of story. Challenging this consensus, especially at the time, was not popular. People felt terrorised in their communities, and Britain was in the throes of an angry backlash. 2 days into the riots, 9/10 of those polled supported the use of water cannon. 2/3 wanted the army sent in, and 1/3 supported using live ammunition on rioters. Attempts to understand what was happening were seen as attempts to justify it. There was little appetite for social and economic explanations for the disorder sweeping English cities. People just wanted to feel safe, and for those responsible, to be punished. Inadvertently, I found myself at the centre of one of the ugliest episodes of the backlash. Along with author Drida Say Mitchell, I was put up against Tudor historian David Starkey on the BBC's current affairs programme Newsnight. In a now famous intervention, Starkey began by quoting Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, which warned that immigration into Britain would plunge the country into violent chaos. Powell was, as Starkey accepted, wrong in his prediction that it would bring intercommunal violence. Instead, what Starkey called black culture had turned white people into rioting thugs. The whites, he pronounced, have become black. Attempting to scapegoat black people for the rioting, Starkey used a tortured argument to navigate around the fact that most rioters were not black. His increasingly baffling but clearly carefully planned rant took an even more alarming turn when he argued that if someone were to hear prominent black Labour MP David Lammy without seeing him, they would conclude he was white. Almost paralysed by the scene unfolding before me, I responded that he was equating black with criminality and white with respectability. What unnerved me most about Starkey's rhetoric were the possible consequences. Could David Starkey become a new Enoch Powell, with critics like me dismissed as a liberal elite trying to crack down on a brave historian for telling the truth? Would badges and T-shirts be produced proclaiming, "Starkey is right"? Would there be marches in his support, like there were in 1968 when Powell was sacked from the Conservative shadow cabinet for his racist bigotry? My fear was that he had introduced race at a time of intense anxiety, when people were angry and scared, but what sympathy there was for him was not particularly strong or deeply felt. Since World War II, struggles against racism had transformed how people looked at race. For example, just over 50 years ago, a Gallup poll found that 71% were opposed to interracial marriage. The number admitting such a prejudice today is virtually non-existent. Although racism was far from being purged from British society, Britain had changed, and the public ramblings of a TV historian were not going to reverse that. As the riots subsided following a surge of police officers onto Britain's streets, the government pledged a crackdown on those responsible. With a mood of widespread fury, a furious right-wing backlash followed, carefully nurtured by senior conservatives. One traditional target of right-wing moralizers was singled out for particular opprobrium: the single mother. Children without fathers was one of the factors identified by Tory Prime Minister David Cameron. It was a point echoed by right-wing commentators. The Daily Express appeared to find no contradiction in claiming that we have bred feckless, lawless males who pass on to their own children the same mistakes. And in another paragraph, that fatherlessness is the single most destructive factor in modern society. It smacked of the arguments of US right-wing pseudo-sociologist Charles Murray, who claimed that rising illegitimacy among the lower classes had produced a new rabble. This was classic demonization, reducing complex social problems to supposed individual failings and behavioral faults. Pervading the backlash was the talk of a feral underclass. This was the idea of the Victorian undeserving poor taken to a new level. The rioters and their families weren't just undeserving, they were barely human. Some commentators took this rhetoric to its logical extreme. Right-wing journalist Richard Littlejohn used his Daily Mail column to describe rioters as a wolf pack of feral inner-city waifs and strays, calling for them to be clubbed like baby seals. The idea of a normal middle-class majority versus a problematic underclass was ubiquitous in post-riot commentary. According to Conservative Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith, too many people have remained unaware of the true nature of life on some of our estates. This was because we had ghettoized many of these problems, keeping them out of sight of the middle-class majority. In the febrile atmosphere that followed the riots, the government proposed that rioters living in council homes should be evicted, along with their families. In other words, collective punishment. It should be possible to evict them and keep them evicted, Cameron told MPs, and local councils such as Nottingham, Salford and Westminster announced their intention to do precisely that. Further plans were unveiled to dock the welfare benefits of those convicted of committing crimes during the riots. In this way, a link was made between the rioters, council tenants, and people on benefits as a whole, all of which reinforced the notion of a feral underclass. But a precedent was set in Cameron's Britain. If you were poor, and if you committed a crime, you would be punished twice, once through the justice system, and again through the welfare system. Cases were rushed through the courts, but the sentences handed down were, it seems, as much about retribution as justice. Mum of two, not involved in disorder, jailed for 5 months for accepting shorts looted from shop, boasted Greater Manchester Police's Twitter feed. There are no excuses. The police force in question was subsequently forced to apologise. 23-year-old Nicholas Robinson, a man with no previous convictions to his name, was imprisoned for 6 months for stealing £3.50 worth of bottled water. Two young men were jailed for 4 years, more than many manslaughter sentences, for using Facebook to incite riots in their local towns. Riots that never happened. Steal bottled water and end up in prison for 6 months, but help push the world into the most catastrophic economic crisis since the 1930s, and expect to face no legal sanctions whatsoever. Even as much of the West's bankrupt financial system remains propped up by trillions of taxpayers' pounds, dollars and euros, not a single banker has ended up in the dock. What is more, many of the British politicians baying for justice after the riots had, in the very recent past, helped themselves to millions of pounds of taxpayers' money. 2 years before the riots, MPs had been found systematically milking the expenses system. Only three ended up behind bars. Some had embezzled funds to pay for the same sort of widescreen televisions that were later carted out of shops by rioters, admittedly in a more disorderly fashion. When Labour MP Gerald Kaufman was found to have claimed £8,750 of public money for a Bang & Olufsen television set, he was simply asked to pay it back. Post-riot Britain trashed the myth that Britain's justice system is blind to wealth and power. Just as an economic crisis caused by the market was transformed into a crisis of public spending, the post-riot backlash demonstrated just how effective the right is at manipulating crises for its own advantage. The riots were once again used to reinforce the view that social problems were the consequence